David Murata is our guest, the president of Murata Wealth Management, and he's online at muratahonmoney.com. Has been in the news quite a bit, and I think I saw another one of his stories referenced within the last week or so in the national media. Anyway, David Murata, welcome to The Shilling Show. Great to have you here. Oh, here we go. There we are.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And you're turning into E.F. Hutton, and I think you know what I mean, because you might remember the commercials when we were young, and they said, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. And it seems now that when David Murata talks, people listen.
Well, it's certainly true that there's been a lot to talk about in the news, and the career of financial planning is one that people are more interested in than a lot of other careers, because I think most people want to do well with their finances and they want to know what to do in this crazy environment. And the Obama administration and the government actions certainly provide a lot of things to be worried about. And the solutions that they've provided often just make the problems worse. So I think people are looking for good advice, and they're also looking for a good critique of why the government plan isn't going to work.
And I think they're looking for somebody to tell them the truth. I was listening, and I want to talk about one particular aspect of the State of the Union speech that relates to what we're talking about today. But it's gotten to the point where, this president makes a speech, and I have to put a filter on this thing and say, is there anything here that I can really believe, or is this all spin? And it's not unique to this president, but I think he's taken it to a new level. And let me just bring one example up that I heard in the State of the Union speech. He was talking about the minimum wage, and he was saying that we need to raise the minimum wage because people who are earning the minimum wage will have more money in their pocket to spend, and it will grease the economy's wheels and make everything great. And I'm thinking back to the conversations I've had with you before and some of the topics that we've talked about how to get out of poverty. And it is not by spending everything you get, but the implication was, we just give you more money, you go out and spend it, and the economy goes boom. He's relegating those people that he's saying he wants to help to a life of poverty.
Yeah, it's amazing. We're actually working on an article on the minimum wage. We could probably write 3 or 4 articles on it. One of the tacks we thought about taking but decided not to was simply the fallacy that spending more money is good for the economy. It's a common economic fallacy. It's called the broken window fallacy. And the idea is simply, if you break a lot of windows, then that'll be good for the economy because all the glaziers will have to come in and spend more money. So if you think about it, if you give money to someone and they spend it, that is just consumption. Imagine they buy stuff and eat it. It's gone. There's nothing in the economy. If you give money to someone who doesn't spend it, the very textbook definition of capital is deferred consumption. So they defer consuming it. Now they have capital. And with capital, you can build something that's going to generate real wealth, and that will be better for the economy. So whether you're starting a company with the money or whether you're buying stock, every time someone buys stock, they're freeing up the stock owner to then take that money and go put it to work somewhere. I think people make fun of just investing it in the stock market. Investing it in the stock market is a form of capital. You're freeing up capital for someone who started a company and is selling their shares, and now they have more capital to go start another company. And so if I had a choice between giving money in the economy to someone who was going to just spend it and someone who was going to do anything else with it, the anything else would be a more productive use of the economy. And then Obama says, it's good to just give more money to the people who are going to go out and spend it. But he never really talks about, well, if a minimum wage of $10.10 an hour is good, why not make it a minimum wage of $20 an hour or $50 an hour or $100 an hour? What's the harm with that? And whatever he would answer for that, that's the harm for $10.10 an hour, too. It's just on a smaller scale.
It's very true. And yet, I don't hear too many people. I'm sure there are analysts who are having this conversation or who had this conversation about this. But I think a lot of people look at this and say, hey, great, he wants to raise the minimum wage. That'll work out perfectly. We will have some more money to spend, and people who are in business will do better because people are dropping money in their establishment. And yet this whole issue of, we want to get people out of poverty, we don't want people to be poor, those two things just can't possibly go together. Spend all the money you get, and we don't want you to be in poverty anymore. It's not possible.
It's true. If he really wanted to give America a wage, he would lower the burden of the government spending, and he would lower the burden on small businesses, because although we talk a lot about trickle-down economics, we never really talk about trickle-down taxation. And if you heap all the taxes on small business owners, They have to pay their employees less. They have to charge their customers more. There's all kinds of different things that they have to do in order to keep their business running. And what it means is that while more is going onto their bottom line, it looks like there's a greater inequality because they have more on their bottom line because they need to be able to pay more in taxes. There's actually no greater inequality in the percentage that each party is getting. They just have to pay the taxes for the entire firm, and they have to pay the taxes for their workers and for their consumers because all the taxes are being heaped on them.
And even the policies that are put forward by this administration, the economic policies, and I'll speak for myself because, you know, my wife and I have talked over the years about starting a business and even recently. And, you know, every time I think about it, I think I don't want to deal with all this bureaucracy. And I know and we hear from people who are in business presently who are artificially limiting their growth to stay below 50 employees, or they're artificially limiting their production in order to stay below $250,000 a year in income, because as soon as you click over the top, you start getting hammered. And this is the opposite of what America used to be. I guess this is the fundamental transformation that was being talked about, but really it's discouraging people from being productive and therefore hurting all of us.
Yeah, the compliance is amazing. It's people who don't run businesses don't realize how bad the compliance is. And I've even heard a couple of liberals say, oh, the compliance isn't that big a deal. And when you talk to small business owners, they really just want lower taxes. But if you think about it, we even here in Albemarle County, we have a tax, a business property tax. They just changed it this year to say anything that is under 200, it used to be anything over under $250,000, you didn't have to put on the business property tax. Now there's no bottom limit. So every time you buy anything within a business, you have to keep that on your books until you've retired it out of your company, and you have to pay tax on it basically forever. So I've been trying to talk with the Albemarle Board of Supervisors to try to figure out what exactly does that mean is taxable. And I keep getting the runaround, and it's not clear what's taxable. So, for example, a rug, a nice oriental rug is taxable. And I say, well, how about a $5 bathroom mat? And they say, well, how much does it cost? You know, it's not supposed to matter how much it costs. So it's unclear. Supposedly it's anything that's used over a year, except then you ask them, well, what about a letter opener? Because I have letter openers I use for 10 years. And then they say, well, that's office supplies. That's not taxable. And so it's not clear to me actually what is taxable and what isn't taxable. And trying to comply with that law, it seems to me, really only punishes people who actually are trying to comply with that law.
I had not heard about this change. Did that come at the state level, or was that a local ordinance? Do you know?
It was a local change. As I understand it, my wife and I have four different companies, and out of our four different companies, the insert was in one of the four. And I called, and they said, oh, well, we've got someone else who did the stuffing of the envelope. So, you know, if they didn't do a good job, that's, you know, that's too bad. And it was actually in my wife's business, not in mine. And so I've been trying to figure out exactly what that means in terms of compliance and what we should be listing and what we shouldn't be listing. And I still don't have an answer on that. It seems to me if they really wanted to be welcoming to small business owners, they would tax, they wouldn't tax small business owners' inventory of things that they've bought forever. Basically, it's an infinite tax. So, you know, it's like $2.50 for every $100 you spent, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, except for the fact you have to keep it on your books. And then you have to say, well, this computer was retired, and so now we're not going to tax that because you've moved that off. And now we have to keep an inventory of every single item in our business and when it's no longer part of our business.
It's unbelievable what we're facing here. When we get back on the other side, I want to talk about retirement planning, inflation, and also MyRA and how that might be a violation of federal law. Imagine that. Chilling Show back with David Marotta after this. You are with The Shilling Show, 977-1070 is the phone number. David Marotta is here with us. He's online at marottaonmoney.com. We're talking today about retirement planning, inflation, and the president's very weak MyRA proposal. I could barely believe what I was hearing when it came out. So let's start off with retirement planning, just for people who are sitting out there saying, hey, I want to do it, but I have no idea where to start. And that may encompass a large part of the listening audience who just hasn't put effort into this because they don't know where to start. And then we'll talk about inflation and the MyRA proposal.
Yeah, most people are not saving for retirement as they should, and our rule of thumb is fairly simple. Save 15% of your take-home pay every year, and you should do okay. If you're starting later, that number might need to be higher, 20 or 25%. And for most people, that's a difficult thing to do because they're very proud of themselves so long as they spend every dime they make mm-hmm. and don't go into credit card debt. And the difficulty with that is that no one is going to take care of you. The government is not here for you. The government is not on your side. Social Security is being reduced by the underreporting of inflation every year. And if you're going to somehow rely upon the government to take care of you, you're not going to get taken care of. And so we recommend you save at least 15% of your take-home pay, and you should save it first. And there's one way to do it. It's the thesis of a book called The Automatic Millionaire. And it's simply put your money into your investment account first, and then take 85% of it and transfer it to your checking account in order to live off of. That leaves 15% behind in your investment account. And not only should you be saving 15%, but you have to be saving and investing. If you save money and it goes into anything that's not keeping up with inflation, it's very difficult to make headway toward your retirement goals. Unless you're saving a tremendous amount of money, you need the growth of stock investments in order to be able to more than keep up with inflation to actually win a little bit on inflation. And stocks, on average, make 6.5% over inflation. So if inflation is running at 4.5%, stocks will be 6.5% above that, or about 11% on average.
Let's talk about this underreporting of inflation, because I want people to understand, first of all, maybe we got to step back and say, what is inflation? Because a lot of people think that inflation is just that prices went up on something. But there's a cause for that people need to understand. And then let's talk about how it is underreported.
Yeah, the government measures inflation with a CPI index. And in 1996, they changed the way that they compute that. And so we used to have hyperinflation in the 1970s, and prices were going up at some point with double digits. And everybody was really worried about that. And then they indexed a lot of government programs to be going up by inflation. And then in 1996, during the Clinton administration, they changed the way they report inflation so that it underreports inflation by about 2% a year. And the way they did that is simply to say, if beef prices go up, people buy less beef. So the entire beef prices going up shouldn't be baked in because some people will change to chicken. And if chicken prices go up, they'll change to pork. And if pork prices go up, they'll change to tofu. And so they have a creative substitution deprecator that keeps inflation down. And then they have a hedonic deprecator is what they call it, and which means, sure, your car this year might cost the same as the car last year, but it's got more safety, government-required safety features, and therefore it's more hedonism and more value for the same amount of money, and we'll count that as deinflation. And so basically any productivity gains are taken out of your consumer price index increase. And so, sure, if you're living on Social Security, you can buy a computer, but you can only buy a computer from the 1990s. You can't buy a new one because all the new advances count against you for your Social Security increases.
So as we look at inflation itself, is it just that prices are just going up on their own? Someone just decides to raise the price? Or is the government complicit in the inflation problem?
Yeah, and most people don't understand exactly what causes inflation. Inflation is extra money chasing goods and services. And so what the government has been doing, specifically what the Federal Reserve has been doing, is they have been buying government bonds. And when they buy government bonds, what it means is they accept a government bond, and then they throw a whole bunch of cash out there into the economy, giving that to whoever they've bought the bond from. And so as they buy bonds, they're throwing cash into the economy. And what they're hoping is, I think, that they can buy up as many bonds as possible and print $14 or $15 or $16 trillion. And then when the government owns all of our bonds, we can just forgive ourselves our own debt, and that will solve the debt problem. And that's probably where we're headed, because we certainly can't pay this debt off. And so at some point, we will just print enough money to buy all of our bonds, throw it into the economy, and then forgive ourselves our own debt. And so it's a tax on anyone stupid enough to be holding cash or a bank account or a savings account or a government bond that's going to pay you back in dollars, but they'll be worth less when they pay them back to you. And so it is a tax, it's a form of taxation, and it's a tax, unfortunately, on the poorest members of society who are trying to save but not save and invest. They're trying to save in anything that's not paying a good rate of return.
I had on the program a couple years ago an author who had written a book called Currency Wars, and it was very interesting because he talked about these rounds of deflation of currencies across countries throughout history. And so there's a lot of competition here between countries to devalue their currency. So I wanted to ask you about international inflation, as we've seen running amok in some of these other countries, but also what is the effect on the U.S. economy, and is it realistic to think that the U.S. could hold out on that cycle and not compete with these other nations in the spiral down?
Yeah, it certainly is true that nations who keep their currency strong have more buying power overseas. They sometimes have a harder time selling their goods in the short run, so that there's kind of an effect back and forth. But the dollar is being devalued, the euro is being devalued, and the yen is being devalued. And what makes it more difficult for us to see in America the devaluation of the dollar is because the euro and the yen are being devalued even faster than the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it can look like the U.S. dollar is actually strengthening against a basket of foreign currencies, which is mostly the euro and the yen. And so you have to take a look at it against other currencies to try to figure out what's really going on there. And any threat that we're going to taper and buy less bonds means that the rate of our plummet will slow, and that actually causes the currency to strengthen against the foreign currencies because it looks like we're not going to be plummeting as much as the other currencies are.
So what can we expect? I mean, a lot of people have been saying we're going to see hyperinflation in the U.S., and maybe we haven't seen hyper. But the underreporting of inflation and the empirical evidence that we have is that our dollars are not buying anywhere near what they bought even a decade ago.
It's true. And there's nothing wrong with that. Countries can continue that forever. You can just look at what the Italian lira used to be, you know, and the lira was almost worth what it was, the paper it was printed on. Especially because the size of their bills got bigger.
They had zeros on there.
As the currency got bigger, and you know, for 100,000 lira, you could buy a hand towel, and you know, for 1 million lira, you could buy a bed sheet. It was their currency just kept getting bigger. So it can go on for a long period of time, and you just add zeros on the end. And the difficulty we're having now is that we have to re-mint a lot of our coins because it's certainly true that a penny now takes 2.5 cents worth of copper, and they have a new proposal for the penny that they can print it cheaply enough. And pretty soon, pennies will not be used much in the economy at all, as people just round it off to the nearest nickel or dime or quarter or dollar like they used to do in Italy. But I think for families, what that means is in order for you to meet your retirement goals, you have to be investing in the stock market, and you have to be smart about your investments, and you have to be saving and investing at least 15%, and if you're behind 20 or 25% of your take-home pay, in order to make sure that you're going to have the real wealth built that will keep up with inflation, unlike Social Security.
977-1070 is the phone number if you have questions or comments for our guest, David Morata. We have one segment left with David. When we get back on the other side, there was a proposal called MyRA that may actually have some legal problems as well as practical problems. We'll get into all of that with David Morata and you when The Shilling Show returns right after this. Final segment with David Morata, Ken Boyd coming up in hour number two. We're talking about retirement planning, inflation, and this flimsy proposal called MyRA. And I've had a chance to look at it. David has spent a lot more time with it. So let's get to it. Help us to understand MyRA, which was, drawn into existence by a wave of the magic wand of Barack Obama.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how much you can do, and I don't really understand the constitutional authority to be able to create a new retirement account without going through Congress, but that's what President Obama has done, and he's now, you know, so a plan sponsor for the entire country, and a MyIRA account, you can put in $5,500 with a household annual income below $191,000, but when it hits $15,000, then that's all you can put in. So you can save $15,000, which you need to save about 26 or 27 times your annual income in order to have a good retirement. So you have to be making maybe $500 a year for $15,000 to be an adequate retirement savings.
Yeah.
My prediction is that my RA accounts will be completely defunct in 5 years and a thing of the past. They won't survive beyond the next administration. And then the difficulties with the account is first, the only thing that you can invest in is government savings bonds. And government savings bonds, have currently increased in what interest they're paying from 1.45 up to 2.5. That's a change.
That's a huge change. How did that happen?
Interest rates are beginning to rise a little bit with inflation, official inflation coming back. So that's the government TSPG fund. So for the last three years, the TSPG fund has appreciated about 5.9% over the entire 3 years. Mm-hmm. Inflation, even the officially underreported inflation, has been 6.95. So it hasn't kept up with inflation. Mm. And really, anything that doesn't keep up with inflation and then earn some is unsuitable for long-term retirement investing. But what's strange to me is that retirement plans are required to comply with the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, passed in 1974. And I had to go through a fairly extensive ERISA training to become an accredited investment fiduciary. And they taught us the rules and the things that you can do wrong. And one of them is that you can't self-deal. So mm-hmm. a retirement account cannot buy securities from plan fiduciaries, the company itself, things like that. They have to not self-deal. And self-dealing is a pretty serious violation. But here's the government selling government savings bonds, which fund our debt, and it's the only choice you have. That is just such a product of self-dealing that if anyone was running this in the private sector, mm-hmm. That would be a pretty serious violation, and they'd probably at least be fined for it, if not go to jail for it. And then a second thing is that you have to identify all conflicts of interest, and you have to seek to minimize those in favor of the plan participants. And so it's certainly a conflict of interest for the government to be hawking its own government bonds. If anyone else did that, again, they would be in serious violation. And then the last thing is that fiduciaries are obligated to offer diverse investment options and allow participants to craft a personally appropriate asset allocation. So a personally appropriate asset allocation maybe should have something that's safe, like government bonds, but it mm-hmm. should also have something for growth, for younger participants to be able to craft an asset allocation that's tuned to them. And so the failure to allow diversification in a retirement plan is another serious violation of fiduciary duty. And I'm just surprised that the administration, one, could think this was a good idea. It's just crazy. And second, could do something that was so against federal retirement plan laws if anyone else did it, but it's okay for the federal government to do it because they're the federal government and they can do whatever they want.
David, I had all sorts of bells and alarms going off when I heard this, because I hearken back to previous conversations with you and others on the topic of economics, because there's been a lot of talk about the government grabbing the funds that are in existing IRAs and Roth IRAs so that they could have some money to play with and solve their problems. And I thought, this is exactly that. Now they will have the money. They will be completely under their control. Is that off base?
No, it's not necessarily off base. They certainly get the money to be able to have more government bonds and to have more debt. And if these became popular, then they would have a significant amount of money that mm-hmm. would be invested in government securities. And that's really what the Social Security system is. You give us our money, we will, on paper, give you some kind of a rate of return, and ultimately you'll get paid back on Social Security. But we take the money in, we spend it, and then, oh, by the way, later, so long as we're still solvent, we will pay it back to you. Now, the government defaulting on government savings bonds is small, but this particular process of people giving their retirement security to the government, I think, is just a foolhardy idea. They did that in Detroit, and Detroit government workers had all of their stuff tied up in the city, and then when the city became insolvent, any public employee in Detroit is going to take a haircut on their promised, even in the Constitution of Detroit and Illinois, promised retirement account. And so I think you just need to have control of your own retirement account. And I think the best thing that could be said is that the MyRA accounts are so stupid, I think only fools would be investing in them, and putting their money in it. And you can already invest the same amount of money in a Roth IRA, which is just a better way to take control of your own retirement.
Without any of those limitations.
Correct.
Yeah. David Morata, thanks so much for shedding some light on all of this, and I hope that people make wise investment decisions. If you want to check him out online, he's at moratonmoney.com, and it's always great to have you with us. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you so much for having me.